Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Game Audio Hour, a fortnightly podcast where we discuss all things game audio, from creative ideas to the latest techniques, project experiences, to audio secrets. Here's where you'll find in-depth coverage and opinions related to game audio. And as I read that sentence, I realize the second sentence isn't actually a proper sentence. Has it now been 210 episodes, and I'm realizing that from creative ideas to the latest techniques, project experiences to audio secrets, that whole thing is just an extended prepositional phrase. It is not a complete sentence. So, yeah, guess what? Vincent Diamante cannot English. Bleh. Alex.
A little bit of creative license. That's fine.
Well, Alex, maybe your English is a little better since you're in somewhat closer proximity to the homeland there.
I'm Australian, so my English is eternally questionable, but I try to remain, somewhat understandable. Yes, I think I'll just end that right there.
Awesome.
Moving on.
How about you, Mike? How are you doing?
I'm doing great. And my solution to any kind of grammatical quandary is to either add a hyphen or an ellipsis. And I feel like that is carte blanche to do whatever you need to do for the purposes of expression without being taken to task about whether it's quote unquote grammatically correct.
Or a semicolon, because nobody really understands how to use semicolons.
That's true.
Let's face it. Let's be
throw off all the critics.
That's right. Let's be real. I mean, semicolons, honestly. I don't understand how to use a semicolon.
Anyways, let's talk about some of our actual expertise. At least we'd like to think that. Game audio. So there's a whole lot of stuff out there when it comes to game audio. And I kind of want to mention this right off the bat. I just decided to throw a bunch of money at some potential solutions to my desire for higher quality audio. I just broke out the American Express and spent about $6,000.
Wow. Wow.
Oh, no.
And what device was worthy of such a dipping into the funds?
Gosh, I don't.
Wait, can we make this into some kind of guessing game? Can you give us like a few hints and we can guess?
Okay. Well, let's see.
It better not be like one piece of equipment for $6,000.
No, but one of the pieces is actually $4,000.
Wow.
$4,000.
Is it like some kind of super duper audiophile 30 centimeter length of cable?
Oh, God, no, I would never do that. That is a little bit too crazy. I get my cables from Monoprice. Thank you very much. Seriously, my microphone cables, Monoprice. My digital audio cables, Monoprice. They make some good stuff. And if it's $5, whatever. No, let's see. I mean, I might as well. Let's start with just mentioning where it comes from. So this piece comes from Neve Designs.
Oh no. Okay. Let's see. Yeah. Is it 1176?
No, not quite.
1073?
It is actually a really new product. This was the last thing that they released before Rupert Neve's passing earlier this year. He actually just died in February.
Yeah, that's true. Actually, I saw that news. Such a significant engineer in the audio industry, really.
Yeah.
What a legacy.
Yeah, such an influence on basically every aspect of music production, of audio engineering. Huge, huge icon.
And of course, if I remember, the Focusrite consoles were basically Sir George Martin phoning up Rupert Neve and saying, "Build me a console." So that's a pretty strong endorsement of his engineering skill and musical sensitivity.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Mike, do you happen to have any guesses on what this pretty pricey piece of equipment is?
If it's something that's new, by Neve, then I have no idea. I didn't know they were actually even an active brand. I thought they were just historical, gargantuan figure and lots of emulations in the digital domain, but I didn't know they were actually making new hardware.
Yeah, they've been doing some really interesting things recently, especially in the digital realm. So I guess with that, I might as well just say it. I got myself their Master Bus Converter. And it's kind of weird getting something that is Rupert Neve Designs, and it's actually all about getting from the analog to the digital space. Now, of course, there's a lot of analog stuff happening there before it hits digital. So this thing has analog ins, it's got digital outs, AES, SPDIF, Toslink, whatever. But before it does that, you've got a limiter. You've got a couple different paths to that limiter in the form of a transformer and this silk EQ processing that they've got for the low and high end. It's got a couple different high frequency compressors on it. It's very, very, very nice sounding. And oh, God, I actually went to a colleague's home studio the other day. And I said, I want to see for myself all these different pieces of equipment that he has, because he invests a lot in his craft. He's got very nice pieces all around, API stuff, Neve stuff, SSL stuff. And this is actually one of these interesting things where, okay, here is a single box that I could put in my path. It's just a single box. I don't have to invest in a big rack that I have to put all these different 500 modules into, invest in the cabling, whatnot. No, it's just a thing that takes your analog, processes it a bit, gets it louder, gets it broadcast ready if you care about volume, turns it digital and spits it back into your interface. And I got to admit, I was actually totally floored by how much of an improvement it made to the sound of the pieces that I actually brought. I brought some stuff to his home studio that was multi-track, some stuff that was just a two-track. And there's some sort of weird magic in there. There's some weird magic when I hit that button that says transformer, when I adjust that knob for the silk EQ. It's kind of scary. I just had to do it. I went there thinking, if it's only a minimal impact on the sound of these pieces, you know, it's not someone else's pieces. It's my own pieces that are either really close to being finished or, you know, somewhere in the middle. There's a lot of writing still left to do. But I put that in there and the sound was honestly amazing. And so I just had to do it. A couple hours later, I sent an email to the guy at Vintage King and said, okay, I need to buy this. yeah, help me buy this. Help me spend money on this thing. It's a freaking converter.
could you just give us the model number? I'm just sort of trying to find it on the website so I have reference to it.
Yeah, so it's, well, let's see. It doesn't have a model number. It is simply called the Master Bus Converter, or the MBC.
Okay, I'm just looking at it now.
Yeah, because you know they do have their model numbers for a lot of the individual modules that they've got. Like, you know, like I'm just looking here. They got the 543 compressor and whatnot. But they do have these rack units that are actually a series of these modules in one box. So this thing, you know, you've got some compression, you've got some limiting, you know, you can do parallel compression. You've got some stereo mid-side with the EQ stuff. And then you have the digital conversion on the very end. And it's all in this single 19-inch wide rack unit thing. And it just made my stuff sound good. So I bought it.
Congratulations, Vince. That's so amazing. I have to admit, I've seen in moments of delirious midlife crisis moments. That didn't string together too elegantly, but you know what I'm trying to say. I have often thought, like, okay, what kind of gear would like, would I get if I had the budget to sort of spend on something like this? And I've seen these sort of really high-end converters, and I've often wondered to myself, the obvious thing that one would wonder is that, well, okay, the analog side, sure, yeah, you can understand how that would impart a character and effect on the tone, but the digital side, like the AD-DA conversion, was it DA-AD conversion? Anyway, that conversion process, like, how, seeing as it's, in the end, it's digital, if you removed all of the Neve-branded Silky Q and the Transformers and all of the analog end from it, would there be, like, is it actually worth it for, I guess, I suppose, when you think about it, if it's going to be analog to digital conversion, there is going to be always that analog element that has to have some kind of high-quality componentry in it, I suppose. So that is that what makes it worth it?
Well, yeah, there is the analog side, certainly. The digital side, I also feel similarly to you, but I think that there is a difference, at least based on the limited experience that I've had on messing around with how the digital is wired into each other. So I think in my particular setup, once I get this box in, I'm going to take that Rupert Neve box and make that the master, distributing word clock to all of my other gear. I actually have a pretty good audio interface. It's RME, and RME has a pretty good reputation, although no one out there would say that RME is the absolute best when it comes to their digital sound quality, the quality of the clock, the quality of syncing with other interfaces and whatnot. This guy, I visited his place, and he's got a couple different things working together. He's got the Rupert Neve converter. He's also got a Lynx Aurora, which is very, very well reputed when it comes to the quality of their digital clocking. He's also got some Universal Audio stuff. And he was talking about how there is actually a significant difference. You make the Lynx Aurora, the clock, the master, and everything sounds just suddenly open and magical and pristine. Rupert Neve is not quite there. It's really, really close. And some of this other gear, like the UA stuff, if you make that the master, oh, there's actually a clear difference in the sonic quality, and it's not a good difference. Even though it's digital, it's fully digital, it's things regress. The soundstage is less open. It's less transparent. It's less pristine. I know that this sounds kind of crazy because we are just talking about math, basic math, but I got to hear it. There is a difference.
So hold on. I'm going to like I said in my tweet about last time's episode, I'm going to be the ubiquitous character in the science fiction series that asks the dumb question now so that the protagonist can explain the jargon to the viewers. When you say quality of the clock, the thing in terms of a digital interface, could you explain that? Because my rather non-technical amateurish brain understands that as meaning the stability of timing, but I guess that's not what you mean, is it?
I think that is actually most of it. It is, in fact, the precision of the clock, the precision, the lack of jitter, the ability to synchronize multiple pieces of gear effectively. Mm. I think that's actually worth noting. You know, when it comes to clocking between devices, you are actually dealing with something that has to travel through wire for a bit. You know, for everything right. That is purely math, there's still a lot of electrical work that is part of the process. Things like, okay, it's going to be this length of cable, and, you know, what's the quality of the termination there and the engineering of this thing? You know, that's why, you know, you don't just get a random cable. You have to make sure it is 75 ohm and it's got this type of shielding on it.
Right.
You know, so there is a sheer electrical component to it. And I imagine, I can't verify for myself because I am not that type of electrical engineer, but I imagine that the stuff on things like that Lynx Aurora or this Rupert Neve design stuff is really well done in a way that, you know, something like the UA stuff. The UA stuff is quite good, but I think everyone would agree that stuff like that, those audio interfaces, they're always built to a price point, and there are going to be concessions and compromises when it comes to electrical design.
You said that you took some tracks to test. Were these project files or just sort of stereo sums of stuff that you had done before?
I did not bring project files, but I did bring stems. Like I brought some orchestral stuff, for example, and I would break it down, you know, violins, violas, cellos, percussion, left, center, right. Even if I'm working inside of the box, I do think of it as here is my virtual orchestra in this virtual space that I am miking all of these individual sections individually. So right. I got all of those pieces together, individual WAV files, and I was able to drop it into his stuff. He's a digital performer guy. Yeah, we were just able to play it that way. There were a couple of tracks that I brought just as, you know, two-track stereo. There is definitely an impact there, too. This was really the important thing. I needed to bring my own stuff in order to test out, because you go online, there's plenty of stuff from people testing with their own mixes, but I don't sound anything like them. And honestly, right, a lot of that stuff is very concerned with making stuff that is broadcast ready. In other words, it hits levels when it comes to loudness, when it comes to dynamics, that I'm generally not concerned about, both in terms of the medium, the fact that I'm a video game music composer, as well as the genre. I tend to do very acoustic stuff or small orchestral stuff, and I am not overly concerned with making stuff as loud as possible. So that's why I was actually really incredulous and found myself with, you know, my jaw on the floor using these tools that are ostensibly for making sure that you are hitting broadcast ready levels, and finding that my stuff is sounding good. My stuff is sounding significantly better than I had ever heard it before.
Now, there are a couple of psychological aspects to artistic appreciation, and to some extent, our expectations can color how we hear things. And, you know, this is part of the psychology of selling any kind of audio gear. You know, we're all sensitive to the effect of level and things that are louder or sounding better, et cetera. So yep. I guess I have two questions. One is how this will be deployed in day-to-day life. And then two is looking a little more carefully at the artistic qualities that the device imparts onto your music. With respect to the first, let's say you're working entirely in the digital domain. You, like Alex, perhaps fell in love with the Spitfire BBC Orchestra and you decided to use it for a whole project. Are you going to get any mileage out of an A to D converter? Are you going to send it out into analog land just so this new gear can convert it back to digital and add its Neve magic?
I think that is, in fact, the case. So there is all that stuff that is built in right before it goes through that conversion. There is that Neve EQ and compressor magic that's basically happening. I had some fun, honestly, testing it out with different sorts of dynamic strings, mixing together some of these strings that I have. I do a lot of stuff with modeled strings and sampled strings and, you know, string soloists versus string ensembles on multitracks. And how does it sound when it comes to this compressor and these EQs on getting these things to actually gel together? And I actually found it very easy to do so with this tool in a way that I just had a lot of difficulty in the digital world, working with, you know, summing and routing and getting different EQs in different places to sort of work together in order to fit them into the right space. Yeah, I mean, I know it's a converter. It's I mean, that's in the name, right? But the compressor and the EQ that is in here just sounds incredibly good and very easy to use, just very easy to dial in my sound. or at least a really desirable sound, because it's a sound that just sounds so much better than anything that I've been able to do in the digital realm so far.
So before we go on to Mike's second question there, I just wanted to confirm, what will the pipeline be? So will you have will you primarily use this for a mastering? So you've got all of you've finished the tracking, you finished the mixing, now you bounce it out through, so you go from the digital to the analog through all of the need circuitry, the analog circuitry, back into digital, and then you render the output of this converter, or will you do it on a track by track basis, just like that, where you will commit yourself to say, okay, this track is perfect, the tracking is done, the mixing is done to a certain extent, and then you'll just do that for one track, and then you mix all of those together, or what's your planned pipeline?
I think it's going to be closer to the first, where I feel like I'm really close or actually even done in terms of a mix. And this is really a two-track mastering tool, but I definitely can see myself using it in places. So for example, once I have my string ensemble just sort of set up the way that I want to, and feeding it out analog, putting it through the Neve Mojo, getting the return on that, and then that is the track that I'm printing there. And maybe I'll do it on some other sections of my orchestra, or doesn't have to be orchestra, but whatever other sections or instruments I'm dealing with in the particular track. I think I'm definitely open to that. But I think for the most part, I'm going to be considering it as something towards the end as part of a mastering process.
I see.
The holy grail of the entire analog emulation sub-industry in the digital world is to capture some of the effects that you're describing that this physical analog device imparts onto your music. I think, the dream is we've got this button on the stereo bus and we engage it, and with minimal fiddling, it adds this mojo, right? This analog warmth or this finesse. And there are a lot of plugins on the digital side that purport to offer these effects, with varying degrees of control offered to the mixer, including, I think of BX Master Desk, or to bring it closer to what you've got, there's BrainWorks also has an emulation of a Neve console, the original BX console. I am curious, this is my inner cognitive scientist speaking, if we were to do a test where we take, let's say you take a mixed and ready to be mastered live orchestral track of the authorship of Vince DiMonte, run it through your new device, maybe with minimal fiddling, you're just trying to get the sound of the device, give me the same digital source file, I'll run it through one or two digital things, and we'll let Alex, who will be essentially the neutral judging party, listen to them all and see if he can pick out which one is the hardware device and which one he likes best.
Mm-hmm. I'm game for that.
That would be fun. I think that would be fun. A lot of those BrainWorks plugins are actually really good. While I was testing stuff the other day, I definitely had some feelings that were similar to what I got with some of those plugins, like the Black Box plugin. I think is really nice. It's supposed to be this modeled version of this really big, massive, expensive rack unit for two-track mastering. The Neve stuff that's all about transformers, this Black Box thing, that's all about these different vacuum tubes that it goes through, multiple tube circuits. And I had a similar feeling there, but there was also a usability factor there, which was one of my biggest surprises, that there was something about this particular Neve unit where I found it was very easy to manipulate and dial in. Whereas even with the Black Box HG2 plugin, even if that sound was really there, and not that sound, because they do sound really quite different, even if there was a really awesome, desirable sound in there, it did feel like it was quite a bit more difficult to dial in.
All right. So such a comparison is not going to capture the element of ease of use. That's absolutely true. And if you can get in 1 minute what might take you 20 minutes using a digital plugin, you know, that alone might justify the expense, even if the results are categorically similar.
Yeah.
But I'm still kind of curious, because there are so many routes to getting analog magic these days. You know, you can simulate the entire signal path of Abbey Road Studios, right? Like Waves offers here's the tape deck, and here's the preamp, and here's, you know, like they've simulated each component. So if you stack up all the simulations of Abbey Road components, you get something that's better sounding than if you have the BX, the black box, or maybe the BX Master Desk, or maybe one of the BX consoles, especially when you look at these things where they're allegedly emulating on a circuit by circuit level the original hardware. And then BrainWorks goes kind of off the deep end in trying to simulate the differences between the variations in particular components. It's almost like the same question of, this is a loose and probably bad analogy, so bear with me, but it's a little bit like sampled versus live instruments, because you've got a physical phenomenon, a violinist playing, and then you have a sampled violinist. Maybe that's stacking the deck too badly. Let's say it's a marimba, where there's more of a fighting chance, right? So you've got a live marimba player, and you've got a sampled marimba player. You know, how different are the experiences to this piece of outboard gear versus a circuit-by-circuit emulation of that gear with a little bit of randomness thrown in just to make it feel less static? They're interesting parallel questions. In this case, I think a kind of a taste test might be informative, and it also might, for the listeners out there who don't have, you know, $4,000 to $6,000 to drop on a Neve outboard gear unit, it might restore the color to their face and give them some hope. If we can say, okay, you can get something that sounds maybe 80% as good for $200 or $20 if you wait for the next sale. So I think this would be a worthwhile undertaking that would benefit our listeners.
Yeah, I think it would actually be really cool. I've got... Well, let's see. I mean, I have this piece, for example, and maybe I could just share it probably in a month or so, because it's not attached to any project. There's no NDAs or weirdness there. So once I'm finished with the track, I could probably just throw it somewhere with a couple of different things. Hey, here's the version with the physical gear. Here's the version with BX console. I have a couple of the different BX consoles. I have the original BX console, as well as the SSL and the Focusrite. And those things are really fantastically good plugins. I think the Focusrite one, for example, yeah, that's commonly a $250 or $350 plugin. It is possible to get it on sale for under $100. And I think if it is on sale, it is a must purchase, not just for being a console channel emulation, but also for the usability of the tools on there. It's got a fantastic de-esser in there. The EQ there is just really, really good. I think that's the thing that I'm just so, I am so pushed by, is how usable the thing is and how quick it is to actually make these big changes to the sound and desirable changes to the sound. So, Black Box, for example, that Black Box plugin, I think, is extremely good. I also do think it's a little bit obtuse as well as fiddly. I mean, I guess it makes sense. It is called the Black Box, right? But there are times when I know that, okay, I can spend some time fiddling with this, using this on a couple of tracks in order to add some mojo, and I think it would really help. This, yeah, and I think it was a similar thing with this particular tool, where I'm thinking, okay, if I have time to mess with an analog workflow with a physical piece of gear, how much time is it going to take for me to put in the mojo? And the thing that impressed me equally with the improvement to the quality of sound was the usability. And I feel like I'm basically at a point in my career where that is what I'm focused on. This thing gets me to a certain point. It only took me a certain amount of time. I can reasonably conceive of how to integrate this into my workflow. And yeah, it's at a point where I can afford to do this with the money. I haven't spent anything on any crazy software this year. I'm not going to buy any crazy samples later this year when Black Friday rolls around. I'm very certain of that. My credit card statement is going to say that to me next month. It's the sound as well as the usability.
You should, this is kind of a timely discussion today, actually, because just this morning I caught up with the latest video from an audio engineer on YouTube called Dan Worrell. Dan Worrell is most famous for being the plugin demo guy. He has a very distinctive, wonderful sounding voice, and he's often employed by companies like Tokyo Dawn Records and Fab Filter and a few other ones as well to do their product demos. Anyway, he had a really good video just released a few days ago, which I watched this morning, which was very informative and interesting. It's basically ripping apart the Harrison 32C channel strip plugin.
Oh, right. I've seen a bunch of ads for it.
Yeah, and basically his the premise of the entire video was, okay, the Harrison 32C channel strip plugin, it nulls perfectly, meaning that it doesn't actually impart any kind of harmonic distortion onto the signal, meaning that any kind of, quotes, analog warmth isn't really being emulated. And that's actually been confirmed in a post on GearSpace by a Harrison representative that this particular channel strip does not actually impart any kind of analog character. So Dan Worrell's point, which was very interesting, was channel strip plugins basically fall into two categories. And quite often these days you see products that aren't really sure which of these two categories they want to be in and don't really do a very good job of either. And the two categories are, A, it's an emulation of an analog piece of outboard gear, usually a rather iconic piece of gear or a legendary one with a you know, fabled, mystical, legendary sound, or it's purely convenience that this single plugin contains all of the controls you need. You can learn it, you can get good at using it, and bang, 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 there you go. You've got your sound. You're ready to move on to the next task.
Right.
So it's either workflow and convenience, or it is emulation of an analog sound. I mean, it's not totally relevant to our conversation just now, but in the case of the Harrison 32C, it's kind of neither. It's neither an emulation of an analog. It is actually an emulation of a Harrison channel strip, but because there's no harmonic distortion, you have to ask yourself, well, if you can actually create exactly the same EQ curves in any kind of digital EQ, which he does in the video because he nulls them, then what's the point? Then on the other side, because it is trying to emulate a channel strip, which means that because of the physical nature of a channel strip, you only can have a certain amount of controls on there. It means that, again, if you only have a certain amount of controls, you're not going to have a full suite of the kinds of things that you want to have control over if it's going to be a workflow thing where everything is combined in the one interface. So what's really interesting about this piece of gear that you've bought there, Vince, is actually, well, yes, it does have an analog character to it because it is an analog, or it has an analog component to its pipeline. But yes, on the other side of the table, it's really interesting and fantastic and rather dangerous to consider the idea that, wow, this kind of device actually has workflow benefits as well, which is very exciting.
Yeah, I think that is exactly it. It hits both. I can easily see how this will make my workflow better, more efficient, quicker, simpler, as well as get real sound quality benefits.
I'll be interested in hearing a comparison to that versus maybe the two BrainWorks Neve emulations. You've got the BX Focusrite, which is, I mean, an emulation of a thing designed by Neve, and then the original BX console. And you've got both, so that seems like it's and I've got both. So in terms of running this comparison, it would be very interesting to hear, like, what is the advantage you get if we focus just on the sound quality and not the ease of use element? What do we get? You know, what's the premium get you? What's that last little bit of quality above what can be simulated in software?
I think it would be a hard comparison to make, because if you only ran just a signal straight through the analog section of Vince's new converter without any compression or EQ applied, if it's an extremely high quality, is it without any compression, EQ, or sort of pre-gain or anything like that applied? If it's an extremely high quality unit, it's probably going to be extremely transparent when it is flat like that, which means where you'd really want to hear it is when you're actually using the EQ to do something. And then at that point, only way to make a fair comparison with, you know, the plug-in channel strips would be to try and match a similar setting on them. But then, of course, that's, you know, it's not going to be an A for B exact comparison between the two signals in that case. So, but it will be tough, but let's do it. I'm definitely up for it.
Yeah, and I think you make an excellent point. We should have Vince twiddle with the knobs using EQ and compression, whatever makes it sound best in his judgment, and then we'll twiddle with the roughly comparable knobs on the plugins and see what results we get.
I have to ask though, Vince, you said that of the total budget that you've spent, this wasn't all of it. So there's another piece of gear that you got?
There is. It's actually not fully allocated yet, but this is something that I've been testing out. So I'm going to be getting a summing mixer in, and I have not committed to purchasing it, but it is about $2,000 worth of, you know, it's just a summing mixer. Obviously, summing is one of the easiest things in the world in the audio domain. It's literally just adding stuff. This one is a 40-channel audio summing mixer. It's got, you know, tube circuitry. It's got a transformer-based output path. And obviously, it's all in that analog electrical domain. And I'm very interested in seeing just how much of an impact that would have compared to digital summing. That is something that I'm still not totally sold on, but a lot of people are interested in it. I'm interested in it. And if I can try it out, well, let's see how it goes. This particular one that I'm getting is from Tegeler, which is a German company that notably offers these 2-week trials of their equipment. So once it comes in, I'll be interested in seeing what happens there.
So now I'm totally confused, Vince. How does an analog summing mixer fit into a setup that has a this Neve converter in the signal path? Like how does, because if you're not working with, you know, a room full of hardware synths or like microphones around a studio or anything like that, that need to be summed together all together in real time. As soon as you hit play, all of your hardware synths switch on and are outputting analog audio to triggers sent by your sequencer. If that's not the case and it's all in the box, how does a summing mixer fit into that? Does each channel in Reaper go out through a separate output on your audio interface that goes to the summing mixer, that the output of that goes into the goes back into the computer, and then the goes out to the Neve and then back in again? Or help, this is confusing.
Right. I mean, I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that I do consider the space that I work in, at least when I'm working in an orchestral idiom, I do consider that space as, here is a place I'm setting up my microphone here in front of my virtual cellos, in front of my virtual French horns. And right now I'm imagining all of that signal coming into Reaper right now. What if instead of that, it's in fact these virtual microphones are instead in the analog domain, they're being summed over there.
Okay, so could you just talk me through one track in Reaper and how the signal flow will work?
Yeah. I mean, it's literally just, okay, I've got channel one, which corresponds to my flutes. And, right, you know, it's all virtual, blah, 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 blah. That's going to go to channel one of the summing mixer.
I see.
And then, flutes, clarinets, oboes, well, double reeds, bassoons. And those are just going to come in. And as those are summed together, there's going to be some interesting electrical interactions that are happening between these channels.
I see.
You know, this is just a thing that maybe it has an impact, maybe it doesn't. Right. I mean, I remember when I was in school, we would talk about what is the meaning, what is the real functionality that's there when you put your drums across these 10 channels, and then you put your vocals over here on the right side in the following channels, and then you put some instruments on the other side in the previous channels. Is there an impact? Some people would say that there really isn't an impact, or maybe there is an impact depending on the design of the console. And then there would be other places where you would say, oh, there actually is a decent amount of impact. For example, feeding it into a multi-track tape machine where there is, in fact, a little bit of bleed on that 2-inch tape because you're literally counting the space that is devoted to your bass drum or your snare drum or your overheads in millimeters, right? So there is going to be a little bit of crosstalk there. So somewhere in the middle of all of that is where these summing mixers actually come into play, where there's going to be interesting electrical interactions happening in the signal. And that is going to result in some extra mojo. This is actually a much harder thing to consider. I am not sold on it. I think the thing that really got me with that master bus converter, which I'm committing to buy, is that it sounds good. It's immediately there, and also you get where the engineering is. The engineering is this transformer sounds a particular way. This limiter is designed in a particular way and creates a particular sound here. These summing mixers, it always seems like a little bit of really, really black magic. This is the topology, and because of the topology, the electrical is working in this particular way, and that results in X sounding sound. It'll be interesting. I'm not sold on it, but I'm going to give it an honest try.
Incidentally, how many outputs does your RME interface have?
It has a lot.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it has, I mean, just in terms of what I can use right now, 32 or 48.
Okay, I see.
Because, you know, it has ADAT input and output. It also has MADI input and output. And I don't have that, but I do have ADAT preamps and whatnot. And I can do that ADAT IO. Actually, that's how I have my synths working, where I have my old Roland synths. Those are actually plugged into an ADAT preamp that I'm using to drive it. And then that's digitized, comes in ADAT into my interface.
I see. Yeah. Okay. In that case, it makes a lot more sense of how it would be set up in Reaper. Sorry. In my interface has two outputs. So yes. Yeah. I understand.
I was wondering that myself. That makes perfect sense that you have the output variety allowing you to fully take advantage of the summing mixer.
Long story short, I do have a very nice RME Fireface. It cost me about $2,000 when I bought it. And I decided that this would be a worthwhile investment. I knew that it was good from my previous experience at the company that I worked with. They got me an RME UCX. It was excellent. Not just because of the quality of the hardware, but also because of the quality of the software and the drivers. Those drivers do not crash. It also had a really nice topology for the virtual routing and mixing that you could do inside of the interface. I decided after that experience, I would invest in an RME interface as my own personal one. And so I decided to go for the big guns. I went for the really big guns, especially when there was a 20% off sale. And when you're dealing with $2,000 or so, 20% goes a long way.
I think I can speak for Mike as well in saying that we are mildly jealous, but also very, 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 very happy. It's pretty amazingly exciting, especially, you know, when you go to, I think we've all had that experience in some form or other with some kind of gear where it's just like, oh, wow, like that's actually really, 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 really different. And I can't explain why. So it's really, really exciting that you're going to be able to enjoy that on a daily basis with your production work. So that's great. Congratulations.
Thank you. I really did not want to turn this into an episode of, hey, I'm getting this awesome, crazy, expensive gear. This is like, honestly, this is going to, I'm going to be paying this off for a while. This is hitting my credit card hard.
Yeah.
But it also feels like this is going to be worthwhile. And I could also not just see, you know, you were talking about that whole stuff about, okay, what's the sound quality like? What is the workflow like? I also get the sense that there is going to be some learning depth to it, where I'm going to continue to eke out more and more returns as I live with this gear.
I mean, that's part of the fun of it all, really.
Yeah.
Getting to know it and, you know, understanding its idiosyncrasies and, you know, just sort of slowly growing together with it.
Yeah, I think that's something that's kind of inherent to analog gear. It's like, oh, yeah, if you do this, it's going to sound this way. Very different from, say, a digital plugin. Like, I have this Akai analog synth, and if I blow into it a particular way with this particular bass patch, it reacts in a really surprising and cool way that you just don't get with, you know, like a digital Rompler or even one of these virtual analog synths that you might come across.
It is really nice to hear. I mean, it's exciting, but it's also nice. I would say it's a privilege for me to hear about, you know, the whole thought process as you went through this purchase and the reason that you decided on it in the end, just because it's very, you know, when it comes to analog digital conversion and basically anything digital, it's pretty easy to be cynical, shall we say, you know, just in terms of like, really, is it really gonna, like, if I spend that much money, is it really going to be that much better? Of course, in this case, it's a little bit more nuanced than that because there's an analog part to that signal path as well. But yeah, exciting stuff.
I think it is good to be cynical about this, but yeah. And being able to test it out in the right place where you can properly evaluate, there's a big difference between going to a properly set up home studio and testing out gear and testing it with your own material versus, oh, checking out the rack at Guitar Center. Nothing wrong with Guitar Center, but it's not really the best place for that type of testing.
Yeah, for sure.
Oh, man. This has gone by pretty quickly. Maybe we should talk about other things. Like, are we actually playing any interesting games right now?
I am, but I will. I think I've spoken too much today, so I'm going to ask Mike to go first.
I haven't been playing anything interesting during the last 2 weeks, but I can offer a music, like non-game music report for conspicuous consumption. If we feel that falls within the proper boundaries of this segment of the show.
Absolutely.
So this was introduced to me literally yesterday, and it kind of blew me away to the extent that I think it's worth mentioning. It's a band called Low, L-O-W, and their newest release, which is called Hey What. And this is the only album I've heard by them, so I don't know if this really characterizes their sound or it's a grand departure in some way. But basically, it's, as far as I can tell, it's a duo, maybe a duo with an extra member every now and then. And what they have is a really interesting electroacoustic sound, which is very rich harmonies, vocal harmonies. I'm thinking about that, like for some reason, I think of Abbey Road and that one track where it's really rich four-part harmony. Or maybe Here Comes the Sun, like one of those really thick, closed voice sounds on top of really interestingly processed guitars and other minimalistic loops. And sometimes the guitars are treated with a kind of aggressive, calculated tremolo effect in the literal sense of the term. So it's like the same family as stuttering, but not as obnoxious as stuttering. And it will create a kind of rhythmic groove in what might just be a single power chord with a long sustain. But the application of the you know, the amplitude modulation, the kind of the rhythmic pattern that's created just by the amplitude messing with, if you will, creates a rhythmic feel to it. So on top of this very kind of edgy electroacoustic guitar-y sound, you have these really lush harmonies, which are very harmonic, vocal harmonies, sorry, which are very harmonically accessible. So to me, there's, if you put aside all the kind of postmodern processed guitar, you get something that's sometimes a little reminiscent of the Beatles or maybe some of the more mellow moments of Pink Floyd. It's a really cool sound. It kind of, I just listened to the album straight through and I was quite struck by it. And I'm remembering Game Audio Hour founders, Kyle Johnson's advocacy of more interesting use of guitar in scoring. And this struck me as kind of, you know, since I'm always listening to things as a media composer, this struck me as kind of a really interesting palette, like a really interesting tool set, in addition to being artistically really impressive. So that's a recommendation for y'all. The band, again, is Low, and the release is called Hey What.
That sounds amazing. I'm going to have to go check that out.
I'll put a link in the comments. I mean, in our chat, and you can share it out with the group.
Okay, that's awesome. I'll definitely put it in the description later. Alex, have you been conspicuously consuming anything?
Yes, I have, actually. I've been very conspicuously consuming Horizon Zero Dawn. I'm late to the party, I know, but I finally picked it up, and I've been enjoying it immensely. Actually, the soundtrack is done by the legendary Joris de Man, who is the composer behind my all-time favorite game soundtrack of all-time space universe, which is Future Labs Velocity 2X, which Joris de Man did together with Future Labs James Marsden. Sorry, James. Yeah, Horizon Zero, leave it beyond this great title, but the music is fantastic. The full voice acting, wonderful, everything.
I can definitely second that recommendation. There was actually a Sony showcase last week, and one of the things that they showed looked pretty interesting. It's this game called Forspoken, which is an interesting combination of developers on that. So there's Luminous Productions, who is the team behind Final Fantasy 15, but it's also Amy Hennig, who is a really cool writer who we haven't heard from in a while, but if you know Uncharted, you know her work. Also on the music side, it is an interesting tag team that they're presenting there. Bear McCreary, who is known for a lot of cool stuff on TV and in games. He most recently did God of War, also on Sony. But then there's also Gary Scheiman, who's done a bunch of stuff in video games, especially BioShock. So when I think about their sounds, I'm thinking about something that's actually kind of different. And I'm interested to see how they combine their efforts for this soundtrack.
Amazing.
That sounds really cool.
Yeah.
Heavy pedigree for both of them.
Yeah, I think it's going to be really cool. But hey, that's a couple years from now. For now, I guess we have to say goodbye to episode 210 of the Game Audio Hour. If you like us, feel free to give us a thumbs up, a like, or maybe even a positive review on the places where you can find this podcast. So we're on the major stuff, Spotify, Apple, Google Podcasts. And you could also follow us on Twitter. There you'll find notices of when the next podcast is going to be dropping. So you can anticipate when we're going to be talking about cool stuff next time. We try to stick to that fortnightly schedule. And until next time, bye.